Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We need to provide action and we need to do it now because time is running out.
Torrential rain in China, raging wildfires in North America and Russia, cataclysmic floods in Europe. I asked the US presidential climate envoy John Kerry, what needs to happen right now to reverse climate change? And environmentalist Catherine Wilkinson about how to change reluctant hearts and minds. Then, victims of vaccine inequity, Kenyan reporter Larry Madowo on the price paid by his family for being born in the wrong place. And Michelle Martin speaks to James Tallarico, a runaway Texas Democrat fighting to protect voting rights. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Politics, and in many cases the profit motive, are failing in our climate crisis. That is the message from US Special Climate Envoy John Kerry. As the world is pounded by fires, floods, brutal heat, and cataclysmic storms, in China, a year's worth of rain fell in 3 days. Terrified subway passengers grasped to the ceiling inside flooded cars, trapped up to their necks in rising water as record-breaking rains devastated parts of Henan province. Meanwhile, in Oregon, British Columbia, and Siberia, monster fires ripped through tinderbox forests. Kerry, looking ahead to the upcoming COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, says that in about 100 days, we can actually save the next 100 years. But how many more meetings will it take before measurable, meaningful change actually happens? In a moment, I will talk to John Kerry about the fierce urgency of now. But first, correspondent Bill Weir looks at intense weather devastation across our overheated world.
It is becoming more obvious by the year. As humanity overheats Earth at a terrifying rate, our planet's atmosphere now holds way too much water in some places, not nearly enough in others. And from the US to Europe, corners of the so-called first world are getting their first taste of what fossil-fueled wealth could ultimately cost. There are so many fires burning out west, there's now a fuel shortage for the planes used to fight them. And there is so much dry vegetation to burn, in part because of the mega drought, now covering over 90% of the American West. Scientists estimate it will take 10 rainy years to refill reservoirs.
It's just really a bad time to be a Christmas tree farmer. It's probably the worst year we've ever had.
But while people from San Diego to Siberia have been praying for rain, Western Europe spent the week praying for it to stop. Parts of Belgium, Austria, and Germany are reeling under standing water and mud after some of the worst flash floods in memory.
Natürlich ein reales Bild von der.
It is horrendous, Angela Merkel said after touring towns and lives crushed by walls of water.
The German language doesn't really have words for this devastation.
When the EU released its ambitious climate plan last week, many saw Germany's entrenched manufacturing base as a block to progress. But now, as elections near, politicians from the chancellor on down are calling for climate action. But what will it take to move American politicians in ways that climate marches and strikes have not? Sadly, the data tells us we are about to find out.
The last 7 years have been the warmest on record, and they really stand out from the record that preceded it. In fact, to me, when I look at them, it almost hints at a bit of an acceleration in the rate of warming we're seeing globally.
That's horrifying. And is it safe to say then, to flip it in a more alarming way, these were the coldest 7 years for the rest of our lives?
Well, that's an interesting question. My line of work is not so much making predictions. We tend to look back but having said that, I don't expect 10 years from now that we'll be cooler than we are today. If you're a betting person, it's probably a safe bet to assume we'll be warmer in the future, barring, say, some major volcanic eruption.
Which means that in addition to stopping the source of the problem to avoid cascading pain, we must brace for the pain that is already on the way.
Bill Weir laying out the facts, the figures, and the high stakes, which I then put, of course, to John Kerry from Rome. He was heading to Naples to meet with G20 environment ministers there. Secretary Kerry, thank you for joining us on the program. You know, we've just seen these awful pictures from China, the subways flooded in some areas, and people up to their necks literally in water. It's terrifying. Your reaction to that in, you know, the context of what you're trying to achieve and what you hope China, as the biggest polluter, might be motivated to do?
Well, my reaction to that is horror, as I think it is for everybody in the world, but not just there. In Germany, Belgium, in the United States, in California, and fires. People all around the planet are beginning to feel the impacts that were predicted years ago by the scientists. So there's no surprise in this, but it right now hopefully will create an urgency, a level of engagement that nations need to provide in order to get the job done. We are not getting enough done. We have to raise ambition in terms of our reduction of emissions in our efforts to try to hold the temperature increase of the Earth to a low enough level, which is 1.5 or as close as we can get to that. And China is doing a lot, actually. I mean, China has already, it's the largest producer of solar panels, one of the largest deployers of alternative renewable energy. But, and there is a but, but China is still using coal-fired power plants and planning to bring more online, and its increases in emissions threaten the success and progress of a lot of other countries that are currently trying to hold the Earth's temperature down. So we hope China will join us in this effort. China is a partner. China was a partner in Paris. We really are looking forward to working with China to have a partnership that does what we need to do as we go to Glasgow.
So let me ask you then, because you mentioned the other countries, and actually, I know you say it's predicted and it's not a surprise, but a lot of people were surprised. People don't look at Oregon, which is, you know, has rain and cool temperatures, as an inferno. And the others you mentioned. Look at Germany. More than 100 people died in Europe in these terrible, catastrophic floods. The fact that this is now manifest on a daily, life-affecting way in rich countries, do you think that that will change the impetus for the policies required? Because it's policies. It's not just recycling plastic bags. It's policies by government that are required. Will it add impetus, do you think, or not?
Yes, I believe it will. No question about it. But most of those countries have already adopted pretty aggressive plans for reducing emissions. But hopefully, it will create the extra urgency to embrace even higher ambition as we head towards this UN conference in Glasgow. Why? Because we're not getting the job done, obviously, and we need to significantly accelerate. The next decade, Christian, the 10 years of 2020 to 2030, is the decisive decade for our implementing decisions that avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis. And I hope, you know, nobody wishes for what is happening now. The dome, the heat dome that Oregon and other states experienced was a once in a thousand years event, allegedly. But scientists will tell you it happened because of the climate change and crisis. So we clearly need to get ahead of this, and we have an opportunity to do so in these next months.
So you've said a decade, less than a decade, some 9 years are left to fix this. Here in the UK, they've just for the first time ever instituted a extreme heat sort of emergency, extreme heat warning here. And, you know, again, countries that you say are doing well and are trying and they're putting climate at the heart of all their build back better out of the pandemic. Even Europe, which is talking about no gas or diesel cars by, I think it's by 2035, and stopping the sale of them, you know, it requires industries to pay for those emissions. And that might get, all of that might get bogged down inside and outside Europe. Even the United States of America has problems in these massive, you know, turn the ship of state methods that are required. Where do you see the hope to finally get that actually, you know, turned?
Well, nobody will deny that it's difficult, and
you know, it's hard to turn that ship of state, but it's doable. And it is imperative that we do it because the crisis is legitimately existential, as people have been saying. And you can't talk about it being existential or believe that it is and then not do the things necessary to respond to that reality. And so I believe that this is a huge opportunity, actually, for all of us economically in the new technologies that we need to discover, and not just discover, but bring to scale and to commercial scale and get out there in the marketplace. There are a huge number of jobs to be created. The private sector is already realizing this, and there are now trillions of dollars that are dedicated over the next 10 years to begin to move into that investment. I think economies around the world are going to recognize this is the future. And as the private sector moves, because it is both imperative in terms of sustaining their businesses and their products and so forth, but also because the future is going to be determined by that. So we have a big task ahead of us, but it is doable. Yesterday, when I spoke in London, I talked about the sort of efforts of a World War II, for instance, or an example of what happens when countries can come together, when it is truly treated as existential, and people pull together. We have to do that on a global basis now. We need China and Russia and India and the United States and Europe and all of these entities to come together and leverage even faster initiatives that can address this, because we're not on a track. Even if we did everything that we promised to do, all of us in Paris, we still would have a rise in the Earth's temperature that is unacceptable, somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 degrees. That's catastrophic. So we obviously have to accelerate. And the Paris Agreement contemplated that countries would come together several years down the road and make a judgment about where we are and then raise ambition. So Glasgow is definitively about raising ambition. And if we do that, we can, I think, have unbelievably positive outcomes that help people have a better quality of life, less particulates in the air, less cancer, less disease, less complications of COVID, more cleaner air in our cities, less impact on the oceans, negative with the rising acidity and the warming of the ocean. 90% of the heat goes into the ocean. Okay. That's changing the ocean. So we're really playing with fire, and I don't mean to, no pun intended, obviously.
And we're going to dig down a little bit afterwards in why this message isn't getting through to people, because clearly what you're saying is absolutely what we're witnessing, and yet human beings are not quite doing the adaptation they need to. But finally, I want to ask you this. Yesterday, Jeff Bezos became the second billionaire to head out to the frontiers of space. And when he came back, like many who've been to space, he described how beautiful our planet is, how fragile it is, how must we all take care of it. But he also said something kind of interesting, or maybe alarming. He thought we should outsource our garbage and our pollution, perhaps into space. Let me just play for you what he said to Anderson Cooper after he touched down yesterday.
What we need to do is build a road to space so that future generations can take all heavy industry and polluting industry on Earth and move it up into space so that we can keep this gem of a planet as it is, instead of ruining it, which unfortunately we might do.
Secretary Kerry, your reaction to that? I mean, after all, we do outsource garbage and landfills to places like China, but putting it into space, is that the solution?
Well, first of all, China doesn't take our waste anymore. That is over. And
anymore.
People are now talking about, people are taking about much more creative ways of managing our refuse, the detritus of our lives. We're finding better ways to manage that here on Earth and create a circular economy where we're using products that have already had one kind of use, and then we put them to a different kind of use and we recycle. And I think that's where most people are moving. We also, look, we don't litter our roads. We have all kinds laws against littering. Why would we want to litter the road to space? In my judgment, that would be a mistake. I think we need to create the circular economy. And I think Jeff Bezos is to be thanked for having embraced a very and created a very significant fund that is going to be dedicated to helping to do that here. So I think most people are looking to the ways that we can actually live sustainably. And that's something that is pretty far from our grasp right now, but it's a hell of a good principle around which to organize our economies and our lives.
All right. Secretary Kerry, America's climate envoy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Christiane.
So again, why is it so hard to talk about climate in a way that actually drives real change? Catherine Wilkinson is an environmentalist and an educator. She's called one of the 15 women who will save the world. That was from Time magazine. And she's co-editor of All We Can Save. It's an anthology of women's writing on the climate crisis. She joins me now from New York. Catherine Wilkinson, welcome to the program. You know, you heard me ask Secretary Kerry how to get the stories across. You heard all his, you know, policies and facts and figures that make eminent sense. But you say we have to reach people's hearts and connect the dots for them. Tell me what that means.
Absolutely. So I think the first thing to note, Christiane, is that most of the time, the climate silence is deafening, right? We know that this is true in day-to-day conversation. People are not talking about this with their friends and family. We've had way too much silence from the media. And often, as you're suggesting, when climate has been communicated, it's coming through couched in the language of science and policy, and we're not speaking to people's values and beliefs, right? We understand this with so many other topics. We have to tell human stories that reach not just our heads, but our hearts, and quite literally bring it home for people. When we start with the things that people already care about and connect the dots to those things, we are welcoming people in rather than expecting them to have a PhD in climate science before they can join the conversation.
So can you give me, Catherine, a bit of an example? Because, again, Secretary Kerry and many economists rightly point out that this is the future economy of the world. This is what's going to, you know, really drive the world, this technology that will help in our climate crisis. And yet, you know, people seem not to still want to, you know, want to take notice of that, as we've seen in the hostility, not just hesitancy over vaccines, the ongoing hostility about the idea of science and climate. Give me a few examples of reaching the heart and how you have seen that it might have made a difference, even on a small level.
Absolutely. Well, I think when we're talking about reaching people's hearts, it's worth remembering that the messenger is just as important as the message. And when we take a step back and look at whose voices are we hearing on the climate crisis, the data tells us that we are mostly, we meaning the public, are mostly hearing from white men, and we absolutely need them on the team. But when we look at polling data, it's actually people of color and women who are the most concerned about climate change and ready to engage. They're also disproportionately affected by climate impacts. So we've got a mismatch. And I think when we look at something like the anthology that I co-edited with Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, we deliberately created a kaleidoscopic approach. 41 women climate leaders, essays from them, but we also incorporated art and poetry so that we're reaching people through different mediums. We're also seeing this increasingly through climate podcasts, telling narrative articulations of where we are on climate, why we're in the mess we're in, and what we can do going forward. How to Save a Planet is a great example. The podcast I co-host with Dr. Leah Stokes, A Matter of Degrees. These are all efforts to not leave the science and policy behind, but wrap them in a way that people can get their heads around and ultimately feel moved to action.
So we have seen, and certainly we've covered on this program, how women are transformative in many, many conflict resolution situations, just war and peace, for instance. And this is a conflict resolution situation that we're talking about. I want to you know, dig down a little bit about this, because you're right. Most of the voices we hear are a particular kind of voice and a particular kind of politics sometimes. But you've written a lot, as you've said. We know that, for instance, you know, in Germany, the leading candidate, certainly to replace Angela Merkel, one of them is the leader of the Green Party. We've known about Greta Thunberg, obviously, for all these years, many, many women. You mention a woman called Eunice Newton Foote. I'm not sure whether many Americans know. She was apparently the first person to recognize carbon dioxide's heating effect. That was back in 1856. But she's a hidden figure, at least she's become that. How do you tell those stories, and what actually have you noticed when women get involved on this issue?
Yeah. It's not just sort of a sounds nice, right, that women should be at the table and leading. What we actually see is a growing body of research that tells us this is a really critical strategy for how we win, because we see that at a national level, when women have higher political, social, economic status, that correlates with lower emissions. We see that when women are present in shaping environmental policy, the outcomes are more effective. Parliaments are more likely to ratify environmental treaties. This is really a strategy, women's leadership, to get to the outcomes that we need. And the same thing is true when we think about the leadership of people of color. We have had what Jeff Bezos, to me, was saying in his comment is, let's just make all of space a sacrifice zone. Well, we know that making certain places sacrifice zones have meant that communities of color have suffered disproportionately from the extractiveness and the pollution of the fossil fuel economy. We cannot keep going forward like that. And so we need to be thinking about, who are we hearing from when we hear what is and isn't a solution? Who does and doesn't benefit from that solution? And how do we move things forward? So this is really critical. And people may not have heard of Eunice Newton Foote. She is someone who did really groundbreaking research in the middle of the 1800s. We don't even have a photograph of her, but we celebrate other men who were doing similar research in that era as founders of climate science. And we can't continue to make those mistakes. She was trying to tell us what was possible.
And then, you know, to our responsibility, certainly mine and my colleagues as journalists, you know, many journalists are caught in this, you know, you have to sort of do the plausible deniability. At least that's what they thought. Now, many, many news organizations are taking it super seriously, calling it what it is, you know, just going with the science and not entertaining the denials. But just this week, there was, we've had terrible weather in Europe. And on the television here, we had the descriptions of what was going on. And a climate scientist said the following. He said, instead of reporters saying, you know, after some cataclysmic climate event, linking any one event to climate change is complicated, this scientist says, we should say we know climate change is increasing the frequency of extreme weather events, and single events are made worse by global warming. How much do you think the way we speak on our massive and important platforms could make a difference and shift the dial?
I think it could make an incredible difference. And we actually know this from research that was comparing a decade, two decades ago, the difference between US and UK media coverage. For example, some research done by Max Boykoff. We have to be drawing the connection between extreme weather events and the climate crisis. But we also need to take that one step further and draw the connection to what is causing the climate crisis, and specifically the fossil fuel economy. Because so often what people are hearing is, well, climate change is something that is happening. Well, climate change, there's accountability and responsibility in the mess that we're in. The fossil fuel industry has had agency in causing the crisis and in preventing incredible solutions already in our toolbox from moving forward at the scale and the speed that is required. So we need to be connecting extreme weather to the climate crisis and to the causes of that crisis, as well as pointing to solutions. Our economy has to transform. So we need to be lifting up things like a federal clean electricity standard for the United States, a civilian climate corps, really incredible policy solutions that are on the table today that could help us make investments at the scale of the crisis and take bold action this decade.
So that, you know, it absolutely makes sense. And then the other side will say, well, look, you know, business people are business people. The bottom line is the bottom line. And as you say, so much investment is happening right now still into fossil fuels. So how about the political aspect of this? Pew Research says 87% of Democrats said that reducing the effects of climate change needs to be prioritized. But among Republicans, that number is just 36%. Of course, we know the Republicans weren't all like that all the time. Go back to Nixon, go back to Teddy Roosevelt. These were people who cared about our environment. So what's shifted, kind of, but are things shifting back? Do you notice any change, even in the conservative community, who you've written about?
That's right. I looked at this for my PhD research and published a book called Between God and Green, specifically looking at how the lens and the framing of religion could be a potentially helpful tool for us. I think the thing to remember is that we didn't just end up in this sort of partisan divide around climate in the United States. There was a decades-long, still going, very savvy, well-funded misinformation campaign that specifically targeted conservative white men. Nonetheless, I do think we are starting to see climate truth begin to win the battle of public opinion. We're not there yet, but the latest polling from Yale tells us that 7 in 10 Americans think that global warming is happening. The majority understand that it's human caused. The folks who are sure that global warming is not happening are now in the single digits and getting smaller by the day. So I think it's really important to communicate to the public that the climate majority is real. It is growing. That's a story that we need to hear. But I also think that media companies have some responsibility in breaking up the greenwashing and propaganda that we are still getting from the fossil fuel industry. We're seeing way too many commercials aired on news channels that are confusing the public and sort of meddling the very truth that media and newsrooms are trying to convey to the public. So if we stop giving oxygen...
Sorry, I hear you. Stop giving oxygen to that kind of stuff. But I want to follow up because, as you've probably read, the Murdoch operation wants to start a weather channel. That's obviously bottom line. They see that weather's very profitable. News is somewhat going down. But what do you think? Yeah. Are you worried that Murdoch might do to climate and the confusion and the denial, what he's done to politics and the populism and the denial of, you know, the election and all the other stuff? Or could it be a vehicle to actually shift this debate right where it's needed?
Well, I am concerned about it. I think that it is potentially a Hail Mary, knowing that they are losing the battle of public opinion on this topic. But it's a dangerous Hail Mary because people do really trust meteorologists. They really trust the people who communicate the weather. And we've actually seen outlets like the Weather Channel be quite a good communicator of climate science. So I think there's real concern about furthering misinformation and confusing folks. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I am I'm not hopeful about this news.
Well, we'll keep watching. Catherine Wilkinson, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, just as we mentioned, denial and profit motive can stall climate action. It can also be a matter of life and death during this pandemic. My next guest highlights the tragedy of vaccine inequity. He's reporter Larry Madowo, and he has shocking and deeply personal experience about his home country, Kenya, where just 1.1% of the population has been fully vaccinated, compared to almost 50% in the United States, where he was working and where he got vaccinated. Larry is joining us now from Nairobi. Welcome to the program. You know, you have such a sad and dramatic story, but it's one that is affecting so much of the world. Tell me what happened to your grandfather in Kenya, where you are now.
So, Christian, this is something that is not unique to me. And since I wrote this piece on CNN.com, I've heard from so many other people across Africa who share a similar story. My uncle died about 5-6 weeks ago now, and I heard about his death just as I was coming from filming a piece for CNN in Uganda, in the capital, Kampala, and that was an overwhelmed ICU. And my uncle didn't have a chance to get vaccinated, and so within a few days, he was on oxygen, and then he was gone, I think within 3-4 days. And the same week that he died, my grandmother, who's about 96, was put on a ventilator. We are giving her artificial oxygen so she can keep breathing because she cannot breathe on her own. And the difference is that for me, I was living in the United States. All I needed to do to get vaccinated back in April was walk into a CVS, a drugstore, and get a vaccine. And there were so many more appointments available at Walgreens, and the DC Health Department emailed to say you can now book an appointment. Anybody over the age of 12 in the US can get vaccinated. For my grandmother, who was 96, she had no access to a vaccine. In Kenya, only 1.1% of people, like you mentioned, are vaccinated. And the reality of that is that people like my grandmother might die because of this unequal world where kids in the West can get vaccinated and older, vulnerable people in this part of the world have no access to this protection.
Yes, I'm sorry, it was your uncle, and now your grandmother is in grave danger. I want to ask you about what the head of the WHO has called this, basically a moral catastrophe and a moral catastrophic failure. You have talked about, and you wrote in this powerful piece, when you meet people in Africa, they are baffled by what we keep reporting about, the vaccine hostility, the resistance to going to get the vaccines. And you've said some Americans are even getting bribed with beer, donuts, or cash to get COVID-19 shots, while many Africans would happily take them for free if they were available. While the world's wealthiest appear to be entering a post-pandemic life, the rest of us in the global South are still in the throes of a devastating crisis with no way out for the foreseeable future. How do you see it as a reporter and what you're witnessing, you know, playing out? How do you see, you know, the situation coming to a head or so in Africa and elsewhere in the poorer part of the world?
The uncomfortable situation for me, Christian, is that I'm a reporter. I report facts here on CNN. I don't give opinions. And yet the truth here, and you say it's about facts, not neutrality. The truth here is that there's an equal world where poorer countries, like many of the countries that I report on in Africa, just don't have access to vaccines. And even when they follow the World Health Organization guidelines about social distancing and masking, like Rwanda has done, it's got one of the strictest rules about making sure you wear a mask and social distancing and restrictions on gatherings. They are still right now in a new lockdown because they were just overrun by cases. The Delta variant is 60% of the cases they're seeing there, and they've had to introduce a new lockdown. And so many people that I've reported on know this firsthand, not just my family, but also many of the people I've been hearing from, people across the continent. South Sudan next door, the world's youngest nation, has completely run out of vaccines. They've shut down the program because they don't know when they'll be getting new vaccines. In Uganda, they're at the back end of another lockdown. Tunisia's healthcare system, Christian, has collapsed entirely.
I actually want to play a little clip from your piece from Uganda. And just to say also that last week, the World Health Organization regionally said that the cases have increased by 43% in a matter of just a week. So here's a clip from your piece from Uganda.
Every patient in this wing of this small private hospital is on life support. It's also taking a strain on the staff, some of whom have had to do 24-hour shifts because the need is far greater than the medical professionals available.
The average age of the patients is 40, doctors tell us. The youngest was only 18.
Why exactly are we seeing young people? One is that for sure it's a more aggressive strain. But the other thing also could be that, you know, after the first wave, we might have gotten quite excited enough to slacken on, on our preventive measures.
I mean, it's such a stark example of what we now know. At the beginning, everybody was saying, we're all in this together, the whole world is facing this. But the truth is, we're not all in this together in the same way.
No, we're not. And that's quite clear. When you see the entire African continent has only vaccinated 1.5% of the population, of the 3.5 billion vaccines that have so far been issued around the world, only 1.6% are Africans. That's how stark it is. So I think when you hear that mantra that we're all in this together, you can see the hollowness of it because not every part of the world has had equal access to the vaccines. Even when some African countries could afford to buy vaccines, they were just not available. When countries in the West, like the UK and the US and Canada, have vaccines, enough vaccines to vaccinate their populations several times over, and yet people here are dying. Often older people who already have underlying conditions or terminal illnesses that cannot afford this extra attack from this vicious virus, and that's what we're seeing here. And for me, as somebody, I was living in New York at the beginning of the pandemic last spring, so I saw what it does, it devastates people. I was a BBC correspondent reporting on the pandemic all over America, and yet here it is now for me with my own family, seeing just the pain we've been through. And I was watching it yesterday, Christiane, with Chimamanda Adichie, the Nigerian writer, and I agree with her about the performative public expression of grief that we Africans have. Her people in the Igbo and we the Luo in Kenya have very similar ways to say, to see off the dead. And I haven't had the benefit of doing that for so many members of my family. And that really just accentuates the pain.
It's really important that you're there. It's really powerful, you know, ground zero, really, reporting. So thank you for keeping the world honest there, Larry. Thanks. And turning now to the United States, where a group of Texas state Democrats have come to Washington, D.C. to battle a restrictive new voting law. The Republican-backed bills disproportionately obstruct voting access amongst ethnic minorities. One of those Texas Democrats is the state representative, James Tallarico, and he's joining Michelle Martin to explain what needs to be done to protect national voting rights.
Thanks, Christian. Representative Tallarico, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
First thing I want to know is, what do you say, what do you consider the most egregious aspects of the bill that Texas is trying to pass?
Yeah, there are so many troubling parts to this voter suppression bill. It reduces early voting hours. It makes it harder to distribute mail-in ballot applications. It gets rid of things like drive-through voting, which are really helpful for working families. You know, when you got a lot of kids, it's hard to herd them all into the polling location quietly. You know, it's easier to just keep them in the back of the minivan and you just drive through and vote that way. But probably the most troubling to me is the part of the bill that empowers partisan poll watchers, untrained partisan poll watchers, to intimidate voters at the polling place. I represent a district in Williamson County, Texas, where I grew up. And some of my constituents are my family members, including my mama. And I can't imagine her going to vote at her polling place, exercising her constitutional rights, and having a Proud Boy breathing down her neck as she does so. This is obviously political, but it's also very personal. And I think we all want our grandparents, our parents, our kids to be able to have the freedom to vote in the state of Texas and be able to vote without fear of intimidation.
Well, why do you say that, though? I mean, why couldn't it go the other way? I mean, there was this famous case, you know, years ago in Philadelphia, that was a big sort of cause with the right-wing media, where these members of the New Black Panther Party, two, you know, with their hats and some outfits, were at a majority Black poll in Philadelphia and said that they were providing security. And some white people from outside of the district were sort of driving around, not sure why, and found the presence of these people intimidating, even though that wasn't even their polling place. And of course, it became a big case and they sued, and therefore these two individuals were prosecuted, and there we go. So I guess what I'm wondering is, why couldn't it be the other way, that people of the New Black Panther Party could sort of decide that they're gonna descend on, you know, wherever and do the same thing? How do you know it's directed toward people of color?
Yeah, this bill would open it up to any partisan actor to come in and disrupt the operations of a polling place, which should be disturbing to everyone, Democrats, independents, and Republicans. You know, the only reason that I bring up the fear about the Proud Boys is because I haven't seen the Black Panthers storm the U.S. Capitol, and I haven't seen them question the legitimacy of the last election. And so what I worry about is, given the current climate, what type of people are going to be attracted to this role of being a poll watcher? I think we need to be very honest that there is no, we don't want to paint a false equivalency. One side of the political aisle has questioned the legitimacy of American elections, and one side hasn't. And so we've got to be very honest and clear-eyed about that fact.
But one of the reasons I'm curious about this is, I'm just curious about why you see it so differently from your Republican colleagues. I mean, if they're going to change the rules, why do they assume that these will redound to their benefit?
You know, so I should say that the opposition to this bill has been bipartisan. So some Republicans do believe that this is undemocratic and un-American. One of my Republican colleagues in the state house joined us in voting against this bill the first time around back in the spring. And his argument was really interesting. He said that in the 2020 election, we saw historic voter turnout in the state of Texas, and Republicans did quite well. They won at all levels of the ballot, up and down the ballot. We have to convince our Republican friends and colleagues to believe in democracy again. Unfortunately, the modern Republican Party has become a minoritarian party. They don't feel that they can or need to create a majority governing coalition. And, you know, they've lost the last seven of the last eight popular votes in this country, which is a troubling statistic for them. So we've got to have both political parties invested in the democratic system if this is going to survive for future generations.
Well, you know, of course, the governor, Greg Abbott, says that if you return to Texas or whenever you do, he will arrest all of you. He also implies that this is kind of a junket, like a fun junket you all are on, that you're, you know, on private planes and hanging out in Washington hotels and essentially shirking your duties. What would you say to that?
You know, this is anything but fun. We have left behind everything we love back in Texas, and many of my colleagues, especially those who are over the age of 65 or those that have pre-existing conditions, are risking their health by traveling in the middle of this active pandemic. I have colleagues of mine who are quarantining in their hotel rooms right now because they've been exposed to the virus. But all of that is worth it because this is bigger than any individual legislator. It's bigger than any individual American. This is about whether or not our precious democracy will survive. You know, we just celebrated America's birthday, and if we expect this American experiment to survive for another 245 years, then we've got to stand up now. Democracies around the world die slowly. It's not something that happens overnight. You can't point to a particular date and time when the democracy withered on the vine. It just happens over time when journalists and when elected officials refuse to stand up for democratic values. And I refuse to let that happen in my beloved home state of Texas or in this country that we all share.
Initially, I think the move that the Texas Democrats made sort of to break quorum, to come to DC and make the commitment to wait it out, even facing, you know, arrest and sort of ridicule in the state, got a lot of attention. But now a lot of the political writers are saying, you know, well, what else you got? You know, that really all you have is headlines. And what do you say to that? That there really is no strategic way forward here. And when you look at the numbers, you can kind of see the point. I mean, the reality of it is in Texas, you know, Republicans control 18 seats in the state Senate, Democrats only 13. They control 83 seats in the House, Democrats only 67. And structurally, that's true around the country. Republicans control far more state legislatures than Democrats do. And that's been a long-term project of theirs. So what do you say to people who say, you know what, you lost that war long ago?
So I'd say a couple of things. One is, you know, you have a little old state rep from Texas on your show talking about voting rights. So I think in some ways we've already won by focusing the national attention, the national conversation on the issue of democracy and on the issue of voting rights. So that's one. Two, the reason that we're in Washington, D.C. right now and not in New Mexico or Oklahoma or Louisiana, which would be, as you know, much more convenient for all of us in Texas. The reason we're in our national capital is because we are begging, pleading, imploring our federal counterparts to take federal action to protect voting rights. That's the only way we can stop Republican held legislatures around the country from undermining the sacred right to vote. And last, you know, we heard this week from the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. We heard from Dolores Huerta, the civil rights icon. Both reminded us that although journalists are sometimes focused on who's winning the day or who's winning the week, that this struggle is a lot longer than any individual news cycle. So we may not win each individual day, we may not win each individual week, but the hope is that we're bending that arc of the moral universe towards justice. And that's bigger than any one of us, and it's bigger than anyone's career. It's about this American experiment and whether it will survive for generations to come.
Well, there are one or two of you in Washington, Democrats, I mean by that, who do have sort of an outside or bigger than usual voice in this. And that's Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. And these are the structural problem that we spoke of earlier extends to the United States Senate, where it's a 50-50 Senate with the vice president being a Democrat, obviously, Kamala Harris, being in a position to break the tie. But that only works if the Democrats are willing to forego the filibuster, you know, a Senate rule, which makes it easier for the minority or the even or their equivalent at this point right. to block legislation. They could do that. But these two Democrats are saying that they won't do that. And I'm just wondering what kinds of conversations you've had with them. I know that your group met with Senator Manchin sort of last week. I don't know whether you've met with Senator Sinema yet, but how are those conversations proceeding?
You know, we left the meeting with Senator Manchin feeling very optimistic that a voting rights bill was possible in the U.S. Congress. And, you know, Senator Manchin is a former Secretary of State. He knows all about election law. He cares a lot about voting rights. He reiterated that multiple times in the meeting with our delegation. And so I'm confident that we have an ally in Senator Manchin. Now, we may disagree about what tactics are necessary to get us there or what the bill may look like. Many of us support, you know, the full version of the For the People Act because the attack on democracy is multifaceted and it requires a comprehensive solution if we're gonna save our democratic system. But my constituents in Texas are out of time. You know, they're having their sacred right to vote undermined as we speak, as I'm talking to you right now. And so we need at least some federal voting rights action to protect the rights of my constituents, my former students, my family members back in Texas. And so I am very hopeful that some type of action on voting rights will pass through the U.S. Congress and will be signed by President Biden.
That's one of the issues I wanted to talk to you about while I have you. You've gotten a lot of attention for a couple of exchanges you've had with people with some different political views. One of them that kind of stood out was an exchange you had with a fellow lawmaker around critical race theory or around a bill that would regulate how history can be taught in Texas schools.
When you look at this side-by-side comparison throughout the bill, it reads like a how-to guide in historical whitewashing. Are you aware that this new version of the bill from the Senate removes the writings of Frederick Douglass?
I am.
Are you aware that this new version of the bill from the Senate removes the writings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yes.
Are you aware that this new version of the bill from the Senate removes the history of Native Americans?
The way the bill is laid out,
that's a yes or no question.
Because we
are
very clear,
are you aware
that
this new version of the bill
about every single document out there that we could,
Native Americans?
I'm going to give you an answer. You're not. This isn't a trial.
But why would it remove those writings? What's the stated reason for taking those out?
if you could get an answer to that question, I'd be very appreciative. But I think what you're seeing is the farthest fringes of the Republican base want to see a certain type of white power preserved, both cultural, political, and social. And that's how they're attempting to do this. You know, I don't think it's all Republicans, and I certainly don't think it's all of my Republican colleagues, but we've got to see a little more political courage from members of the Republican Party to stand up to those voices in their own coalition.
One of the things about that Texas bill that stood out to me is that it would require things to be removed from the curriculum if they caused distress, if they made somebody feel uncomfortable at hearing it. And I just, as a teacher, I'm curious about how that strikes you. And so I'm thinking, gosh, if learning chemistry made you uncomfortable, would you say you can't, calculus or algebra or geometry or trig or whatever, you say, oh, that makes me uncomfortable. Would you not teach that? Or, I mean, I'm just saying, as an educator, how does that strike you? How's that actually going to work?
So I always had one rule in my classroom as a teacher, and that was to be honest with my students. You know, kids have some of the best BS detectors around, right? They can tell when you're not shooting straight with them. And if true learning is going to happen, if true growth is going to happen within the classroom, if you're going to cultivate a deep relationship between a teacher and a student, it has to be built on trust. And it has to be built on honesty. You know, I think some of my colleagues, maybe authentically, feel that if we're honest with our kids about our history, if we're honest about the good, the bad, and the ugly of our past, that students will stop loving America. That has not been my experience. Ronald Reagan talked about informed patriotism. And I think that's what we're trying to achieve in our classrooms. We want our students to develop a true love of country, right? And just like in any relationship, True love means that you recognize someone for who they are, everything about them, the good parts and the bad parts, and you choose to love them anyway. You make a commitment. That's different from puppy love, right? When you were younger, when you didn't really know anything about the person, you just liked, you thought they were cute, you liked, you know, that they were funny, and that's about it. It's superficial. What the Republicans are trying to do with this bill is instill a puppy love of country. And I think what we have to do, especially at this moment in our history, is instill a true love of country from within our students.
Before you go, you know, I'm just wondering, what do you think happened in your state? A former governor, George W. Bush, later became, of course, President Bush, you know, the 43rd president of the United States, was noted for his bipartisanship. I mean, he had, you know, a cabinet of people who he regularly consulted with people who were Democrats. He was known for having good working relationships with Democrats. He was known for, as president, had a diverse cabinet. His nominating convention was one of the most diverse in history, ethnically and racially diverse. I'm just, you know, like, what happened here? What do you think happened?
So something I've learned in politics is to focus less on personalities and focus more on systems. You know, I think if former President Bush or former Governor Bush, as is the case here in Texas, you know, if he were in the Republican Party today, I think you'd see him act a lot more like former President Trump and Leader McConnell and others, because politicians are rational actors. We pursue what incentives are put in front of us by the systems in which we work. And so what you're seeing in this current political system is the Democratic Party, because of our geographic distribution, right? The Senate and the Electoral College get special preference to white rural states, as we all know, which tend to be in the Republican category. Because of that basic structural fact, it forces the Democratic Party to try to appeal to as many voters as possible to build a majority coalition. You know, you saw that in President Biden and Vice President Harris in their campaign for the White House. You know, they were not just trying to appeal to the Democratic base. They were trying to build a coalition of progressives and moderates and suburban voters in order to win, because the system forced the Democratic Party to do so. Because of these structural factors, the Republican Party can win an election through the Electoral College and maintain power through the Senate by appealing to a shrinking minority of white rural voters, primarily men. And that's bad for democracy, because that means that one party doesn't feel the need to govern for the entire country. They only feel the need to govern for their shrinking minority. And that leads to bad policy outcomes, like we've already been discussing, the voter suppression bill and the historical whitewashing bill in the Texas legislature.
So, you know, there's a chance that you could lose your seat as a consequence of the decision you've made. There's a chance you could get arrested. I don't know how real a possibility that is. But let's say you do lose your seat. Will it have been worth it?
Absolutely. I'll be able to look myself in the mirror every night before I go to bed. And that's worth more than any political seat you could ever have. I also know that my community members, my family members, my former students will be proud of me. And that's all you can really ask for in this life. Being an elected official is a wonderful honor. It's a wonderful privilege. But if it comes at the cost of sacrificing your own principles, your own beliefs, your own values, then it's not worth having. And so I know what we're doing here is right. I know that we are honoring the legacy of brave Americans from Normandy to Selma, who have spilled blood to sacrifice and to stand up for the sacred right to vote. And that's all you can ask for.
Representative James Tallarico, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Following his conscience. And finally tonight, let the games begin. The Olympics kicked off today in Japan ahead of the formal opening ceremony on Friday. On everybody's mind, though, is what impact COVID will have on the competition. But that is not the only sports news making waves. Norway's women's beach handball team, there they are, were fined by the European Handball Federation for wearing shorts instead of bikini bottoms to a European Championship game. Now, the guidelines say that female athletes must wear bikini bottoms with a close fit and cut on an upward angle towards the top of the leg. Seriously? Men, on the other hand, must wear shorts that are not too baggy and 10 centimeters above the kneecap. Meanwhile, the double Paralympic sprint and long jump world champion Olivia Breen says that she was speechless when an official at the English Championships told her that her sprinting briefs were too short and therefore inappropriate. So some bottoms are too long, some bottoms are too short. Maybe it's time to let women decide just what is their bottom line. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Bianca Goldariga will take you through the rest of the week. I'll be back on Monday. See you then. Thanks for watching. Bye-bye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.